On the field, winning comes from hard work, care, and preparation. I learned that that same hard work doesn't stop when we exit the arena. Your care is our commitment, and preparation is our promise. We tackle challenges head on and turn dreams into reality, which is why I'm excited to join the team at Alcova Mortgage, where we help you score the perfect home.
Welcome into the Who's On Podcast, part of the Saber Podcast Network, presented in part by Joe Reed and Alcova Mortgage. Score your perfect home today. It is time. The season is officially over. I know the offseason is just getting started, but it's time to go back, look at last season, a little UVA basketball season in review, and no one better to do that than the guys that helped me kick off this last season, and that's Zach Carey, managing editor for Streaking the Lawn, and you know him as Cuts from the Corner. From X. Guys, thanks for coming back. I know it wasn't a fun idea to come back and look back at some of our season predictions, but you know, it's the job that we got to do.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks.
All right. Well, we'll start with a season recap just to kind of set the stage here. That's how we started in the preseason. We kind of did an off-season review, and there's a lot to talk about there. There's a lot to talk about now. We'll start with Tony Bennett retiring, obviously 3 weeks away from the regular season. We've heard that one a lot. Ron Sanchez shortly after named the interim head coach. You had the whole Jalen Worley transferring. We now know that he's going to Gonzaga. Christian Bliss and that whole saga. Will he, won't he play? Well, he didn't play. Zach, you've got a fun prediction that you made in the preseason that we can kind of talk about later with Christian Bliss. Then on the court for UVA, started 3-0. I got a win against Villanova, who we now know is, you know, struggling, and they're going to be looking for a new head coach as well. Blown out in the Bahamas. I think that was the first sign that, all right, maybe this isn't going to go quite the way that we had hoped, when they couldn't even get within 20 points of either of those teams. But also, on the other side, you got to look at those two teams. Tennessee and St. John's are both two seeds in the NCAA tournament. Five-game losing skid in ACC play. That was the longest since 2009-2010. You could pretty much say anything this year was the longest or the worst since 2009-2010 or even 2008-09. That's kind of how the stats work out. And then won 3 games in a row at Pitt versus Georgia Tech and at Virginia Tech. Obviously, Georgia Tech, Tony Bennett Day. Didn't really have that on my cards this year, maybe in the future, but we got it already. And then, of course, falling in the ACC tournament to Georgia Tech and Ron Sanchez 3 hours later in the team hotel was told that he would not be retained. And that kind of brings us up to the date. Guys, what happened? Zach, tell me what happened.
Oh, man. It's a complicated question. I think, you know, Tony retired. And at some point that was going to happen. We talked about it preseason. I think that as we will see in some of our predictions at looking back at them, we and I'm sure many in the UVA fan base still had faith that sort of the floor that Bennett had set at UVA would still be there. And I don't know if that's because he retired or just because of the roster makeup this year, probably a little bit of both. But that floor wasn't there this year. That's why a lot of things were the worst they've been since Bennett got here. And honestly, you know, when you look at some of the analytics, worse in a long time, even like in the 21st century. The team still stuck together to some extent. Like that's what we were hearing in the post-game press conferences. It wasn't like, at least from the people that they gave us, it didn't seem to be any sort of any issues internally, and they did win some games down the stretch that at least allowed for some moments of fun for UVA fans. So I think we can get into sort of individual players and who sort of performed up to expectations, exceeded, and then, you know, a number who sort of didn't quite hit what some of those preseason expectations were. And I think that by and large is why this team didn't necessarily accomplish what some of us thought that they could or would.
Yeah, you look at Isaac McNeely, to your point, pointed out that this is the closest he's been on a team to his teammates. And so, obviously, a little bit of maybe trauma bonding from all the things that have happened this season. But Cuts, I don't think even the most pessimistic people in the world kind of had this in their kind of radar. At one point, we're talking about UVA possibly missing the ACC tournament altogether. Obviously, that didn't happen. I never really bought into that. I thought that there's a pretty clear bottom three in the ACC, and that kind of showed itself over time with NC State, Boston College, and Miami. But I don't think many people were predicting this before the season.
Yeah, no, and I mean, even if you look at, our predictions, they ranged, but they were still pretty like competitive to potentially make the tournament or at least be an NIT team. So certainly not. I think the answer is in how, something Coach Sands had said toward the end of the season. He said his goals in coaching this team sort of went beyond win-loss record. And I think we saw that like all year, right? Like I think he did a really good job of supporting his players. To Zach's point, the team seemed well bonded and connected. But I think there was also an element of kind of honoring the Coach Bennett legacy and what he was doing, not straying too far from the system. Making some decisions that rewarded maybe loyalty and kind of giving people their run. I'm thinking specifically of Tane Murray. I think he was sort of coaching with that kind of, putting the players in sort of the people element of it first, which is, really admirable and I think is great, but isn't necessarily always going to translate to the most optimal win-loss record.
Before we dig real deep into this season and the predictions that we made and kind of where we ended up at the end of the season, with Ron Sanchez leaving, and I know some people kind of disagree with the time of when the era for UVA basketball officially ended, but it does feel like there's an era of UVA basketball that is kind of over in transition now with whoever the new head coach may be. And we'll talk about him in just a second. Cuts, do you feel like this is kind of an end of an era for UVA basketball? And that's what it felt like the last home game against Florida State, walking off that court. It kind of felt like, all right, that next time we're in here is going to be a little different.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I came down for the last home game with that thought in mind. Just I kind of wanted to pay my respects in a way, see the game. I do think so. And I think, what'll be interesting is to see how many of our current staff, especially like junior staff, might stay on with the next. And hopefully there'll be at least some kind of bridge where you've got those ties to the kind of history of the Bennett era, but like maybe, folks who aren't so entrenched in that model that they aren't like flexible to kind of go with the new coaching staff. So hopefully there'll be some ties there, but absolutely feels like an end of an era. And I think we'll feel it most in just like all of the familiar faces that are no longer there on the sideline.
Zach, age joke. Do you know another era of Virginia basketball?
Nope. The first season I tangibly remember watching like start to finish was that 2011 one. I think I remember them losing to Miami in the ACC tournament at some point. That might have been that year
Yeah, I
or
think so.
later. Yeah, and then I guess 2011 they lost in the ACC tournament. In 2012 they made the tournament. And now that I'm looking back, so yeah, weird. Like very, very odd. I'm lucky, but we'll see how
It's kind of like
things
being
go.
like a Boston sports fan being born into like the Patriots and Red Sox and Celtics years, over the last
I
couple
mean,
decades.
it's funny because I feel like I got in at least like right before. It wasn't like I got in 09 and I was like, man, this Tony Bennett guy, I believe in him at age six. But like at least when I was like 8 or 9, I was like, oh wow, we beat Michigan, who's ranked. That's awesome. I've never seen that before. And then, I got like 1 or 2 years of, I don't know if you call it even mediocrity, but like above average ACC play for Virginia. And then, yeah, straight up.
Yeah, I do think at some point I'm going to dive deep into kind of that era of basketball and just kind of moving forward from it because it did change a lot for Virginia as a program. They were all of a sudden on the tier of UNC and Duke, winning ACC regular season titles almost every other year. And then, obviously the national championship was kind of the culmination of all of it. But, there's some really good teams, some really good players, a lot of NBA talent that kind of came through JPJ and it's set up. Whoever the next coach is, to come into a program that's already kind of been on that national level. And I know they've had a couple down years. You had the embarrassing loss to Colorado State in the first four, and then you had this season to follow it up. So, maybe they've fallen a little off the national radar, but I keep telling people to get back on the national radar for Virginia. It's a lot easier. Just have one good season and you're back there because people have seen what this program could do. So saying that, and it's a new era, I recognize that, but saying that, VCU's Ryan Odom seems to be the odds-on favorite, and it's just kind of the waiting game right now. VCU's going to play, make this note, this is coming out right before the NCAA tournament gets going on Thursday. So right before those games get going, VCU will play at 4:05 in Denver, against BYU. And then we'll kind of see what happens there and just can't kind of keep playing the waiting game. But Zach, just as you've kind of looked, and I know VCU has attracted a lot more orange and blue fans over the last week to watch some of their games. What do you kind of make of Ryan Odom from what you've seen? And if this is the next hire, what do you think?
Yeah, it's a just a question everybody's asking right now. I think what's interesting about Odom is that he's taken teams like a UMBC, like a Utah State, like a VCU. Obviously, VCU has a little bit more history there, and Utah State, frankly, does too. But he's taken these teams and quickly turned them into NCAA tournament teams. He made it to the tournament with Utah State in 2023. Now, 2 years later, in his second year at VCU, he's in the tournament. And so he's done that quickly. He hasn't done the program building. He was at VCU for 5 years in his second year. UMBC played Virginia in the first round of the NCAA tournament. I don't exactly remember how that worked out, but then 2 years, then he's at Utah State for two, and now he's at VCU for two. So I think that he knows how to thrive, or at least at that level, knows how to thrive in the current state of NCAA basketball. And that is important because, with the state of the Virginia athletic program, they need basketball to be good. And frankly, they need basketball to be good pretty quickly. That might not be next year, but it would be nice if it was the year after, or at worst, the year after that. And so Odom is relatively young. Obviously, the UVA ties are there. It's something I've talked to people about. It's like, is the new head coach going to have the same appeal to the community, to the donors, to people that, write the checks? And I think that Odom, probably as much as anybody, will, just because he was a ball boy at U-Haul growing up. His dad was on Terry Holland's staff. Maybe the UMBC thing will knock him a little bit, and now Virginia fans, if Odom is the coach, are going to have to watch those highlights at the beginning of every broadcast until eternity, probably. And that will just forever be the story. However, if Virginia is good or bad with Odom, should he be the guy? So I like Odom. I think that he runs, a good system. Frankly, I haven't watched a ton of VCU. It's probably more cuts right now. They've typically been a better defensive team than offensive team. Not to say that they're a bad offensive team. They guard people for lengthy possessions. This year, they're first in the country in effective field goal percentage. And he also, likes to shoot threes. So I think analytically, he's a good basketball coach. Schematically, sometimes they're a little bit haywire on offense, at least from watching a couple of VCU games. And the pace is a little bit faster, so it's not quite like Rich Pitino at New Mexico. But I like Odom. I think that the idea of him as the next coach makes sense. I think him as the leading candidate makes sense, and then you kind of go from there and see what he can do.
Yeah, I think it's kind of all those things that you said, obviously the obvious connection to the program. It's a new style of play. It's still kind of it fits. It's a good transition. It's not a stark cut to what we've seen with Tony Bennett and those teams over the years. Like, I think culturally it's going to be pretty similar, but at the same time, this is a guy that's very well versed in the transfer portal era. You look at those VCU teams and how quickly he rebuilt them. Most of those transfers, some freshmen that he's also brought in as well. It's not a lot of guys that he carried over from Mike Rhodes' teams at VCU. It's a lot of guys that he brought in and kind of turned this team back into an NCAA tournament team in 2 years, even though they lost a lot of talent. Some of that talent went up to Penn State with Mike Rhodes, and so it's a good mix. And I think what he does recruiting wise is gonna help kind of transition into this new era of UVA basketball, and him working with Wally Walker there behind the scenes and kind of getting this roster together. I think it's going to be a pretty quick transition. But Cuts, Zach alluded to it. You've been grinding through the tape, and I know you're getting ready to write some good stuff over there. But what has stood out about Ryan Odom and his play style?
Yeah, so I mean I've started recording. I haven't I don't want to jump the gun just in case anything changes, but I was able to go to the A10 final at Capital One Arena between George Mason. I've been able to watch some of the film. It's interesting because what I like about Odom is like his system and philosophy stay pretty similar. He likes to push the tempo after misses and after makes and just kind of get the ball up the court, try to get a quick shot, which is very different from us. I know we talked about that, in theory doing that, but Odom's teams really do it. They really push, they try to get that early shot. They shoot a ton of three-pointers, and it doesn't really matter how good they are at shooting them, right? Like this VCU team is only 33% for the team, but they shoot a ton of threes. But when you had that Utah State team, they were a really good shooting team. Still shot a ton of threes. So, the offense is geared around early transition, shooting open threes across the board. There's none of this, the conversation we had earlier in the year about, Jake Bukowfi shouldn't shoot early in the shot clock. That's not going to be something you would ever hear from a Ryan Odom coach team. So they shoot, but if they don't get those early looks, then they run their offense. And one of the things I've been kind of interested in noting is that they do have some similarities to some of the looks that we ran in their base offenses, where they're setting pin down screens and kind of running through and getting a quality shot if they're not getting those early looks. So there's some similarity there as well. But within that, what I like is that he transitions between his personnel. I think he's pretty flexible in who he plays and how he plays them. Right. Like, the Utah State roster was an entirely different feel from his current VCU roster. That team lost by five in their conference championship game to the San Diego State team that lost to UConn in the final of the whole NCAA tournament. On that team at the four, he had like a 6'9" stretch four. He played Taylor Funk, shot like 37% from three on eight attempts. That whole team was kind of focused on, they defended, but they, it was more of an offensive feel around that team. It wasn't nearly as athletic as this current VCU team. This current VCU team, one thing that really stood out to me was they were really physical and really athletic. So, at the four position, they have Jack Clark, who's 6'10", only shoots about 34% on the year right now. But he went off in the conference tournament because he had the green light to shoot when he had those looks. But they run between their four and their five. They have three guys who are 6'10" and above, one who's 6'8". None of them are great shooters from outside, and they have that kind of more traditional forward center length kind of ability to contest at the rim. So that's different as well. And VCU, one of the things I was really impressed with is their physicality. Like when they played Mason, I thought they actually like kind of cowed the refs into swallowing some of their wrist whistles over the course of the game because they were just so physical and imposed their will throughout that it was kind of hard to call all of the contact, and it turned the game into kind of like a dogfight. And it was cool to see, a team impose their will and physicality on another after watching this UVA team this past year. So I really like that as well. So a lot of different information, but I think Odom's good with his personnel flexibility. But he still has some core principles in place he carries over from team to team.
Yeah, it seems like it's a lot more flexible just to kind of depending on the guys that he has. You mentioned Jack Clark there, and we'll get into players that you want to stay around and whatnot. But like, I saw Jack Clark and I was like, you can't tell me like Jacob Kofi is not like an enhanced version of that. And so we'll see kind of how the roster shakes out. But one comparison, I want to get y'all's thought on this real quick, that has kind of come to my mind. Because in this day and age, you look at what Louisville did this year, and everyone's like, all right, well, how do we get the Pat Kelsey to kind of re-energize the program and kind of make that big year one leap? The name that I keep coming back to, because I think it's a pretty good situation to like look at as a UVA fan. And I said this on a previous podcast, so if you listen to this again, bear with me, but it's kind of struck me a couple days ago. Arkansas this past offseason hired John Calipari. That was the big splashy hire. But Kentucky, big program, big blue blood. What did they do? They made the safe hire. They made the guy that had the connections to the program. They made a guy that, hadn't had NCAA tournament success at large, in Mark Pope. And I think the safe hire, I know they don't play similar and, it's very different styles of play, but the safe hire, sometimes it works. And you look at Mark Pope versus John Calipari right now, and I'd rather have Mark Pope, especially what he's done in season one at Kentucky. So I don't know what y'all think about that, but I like kind of the, because a lot of people are dinging this as like, oh, it's the safe hire. This is the same guy that you were looking at in October, and it's the same guy that we're ending up now here in March and April. But yeah, Cuts, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's just a good basketball coach. And I honestly think it would be hard to, I mean, people have their preferences on different candidates, but I think it would be hard to argue that he's not, one of the more premier mid-major coaches available this cycle. And then there's so much overlap with the program anyway. It just makes a lot of sense. And a good basketball coach is a good basketball coach, and I think that's going to be appealing, especially because his style is sort of more modern. You get more resources coming to this university. I think that's going to translate pretty well.
I'd also just say timing matters. Like, there are a lot of programs, maybe not exactly in the Virginia mold, but slightly above, slightly below. If you sort of look at the tiering of programs like Indiana, Villanova, Minnesota, there's just a lot of schools looking for head coaches right now. And if you're Virginia and Odom is sort of your guy, then Odom's your guy. And like, you shouldn't be necessarily caught up on like, fit matters. Like, fit does still matter. And Odom being able to say, hey, I'm connected to you, like, that does matter, especially like in talking to recruits, in recruiting the region. I know that's not been a huge thing with Tony Bennett, but like, it might come up with Odom. He's got relationships in the Commonwealth, in the Nova area, in the DMV in general. I do think that that matters. And so, yeah, I mean, if Odom's the guy, I think that that's at least in the short term a win for Virginia.
In connections to program alumni too,
Yeah,
I think
right.
that's going to be huge. Just kind of feeling the pulse right now. I know a lot of guys are kind of bummed out that the Tony Bennett era is over because that's what these guys kind of came up through and they played for Tony. And if Ryan can kind of make that connection and looking at what he did at VCU, he has actually got a couple VCU guys on his staff. That he brought in. They weren't guys that he worked with before, but he brought them in because he knew how important it was. And that's why, when we talk about the staff, like we mentioned before, looking at guys like Isaiah Wilkins, Kyle Guy, Chase Coleman, those are guys that, you kind of feel like he might try to keep around because, I think it looks like he values that connection to the program that he's at, for a guy that's kind of been bouncing around for the last couple of years. Looking at the players in this roster now, we talked about Ryan Odom's going to want a more athletic team, and so some guys have to leave, and you got to kind of have to reshape the roster. So we had our first entry into the transfer portal, although you can't officially enter until March 24th. But first player to kind of declare that they're entering, and that's Blake Buchanan, the big man. Not a big su surprise for me. This is kind of the one that I had earmarked as. He's probably the safest bet to, well, maybe outside Christian Bliss, but the safest bet to head out the door. Thoughts on just Zach, just Blake, and but also just kind of what you see for the roster transition wise going into this offseason.
Yeah, first on Blake, I mean, I think I might need to put my hand up as like the guy who was the, at least in the UVA sports media world, the absolute highest on Blake Buchanan. Maybe it was the Florida game. Maybe I got overly excited. I thought he was like Mike Toby, but athletic. Like, I don't know. So yeah, I think with Blake, like in the end, just the skills and the strengths that he had in high school playing in Idaho didn't really translate. And that continued to be a theme in his second year. Like, so, and he had his moments, and I'll touch on that, but like, just watching him like try to put up floaters from like 10 feet, it's like, Blake, you're taller than everyone else. Even against like the Coppin States of the world, it's like, Blake, you're taller than everyone. Go dunk the basketball. And I don't mean to sort of be mean to him in that sense. I just mean like it was clear that he wasn't quite catching on to ACC competition in his second year. Defensively, he didn't quite have that size to bang with ACC bigs. And then offensively, he's continued to struggle to finish around the hoop and then didn't really bring anything more to the table. Obviously, he did have that stretch, sort of like I think in the middle of January, like through early February, where he averaged like 8 points a game and had three double doubles and was a lot more aggressive and played with a lot of effort and kept Virginia in some games. So he deserves credit for that. Like, he's not a bad basketball player. I just think he probably needs a different fit. It's worthwhile to note that, like, say it's Odom, say it's somebody else coming in, like, a lot of these guys will just hit the portal because it's a coaching change and it's basically free agency. And candidly, like, they need to see what they're offered elsewhere. And then, if Odom comes in or whoever comes in and tries to bring him back, then that's a conversation. I think Buchanan makes sense as somebody who's going to look to move down a level. I don't say that to knock him. I just think, like, he's a good basketball player who could probably thrive at that level more than this one. And maybe that culminates in bumping up the next year. I don't know. College basketball is crazy. In terms of the roster writ large, I think it's going to be hard to maintain, to keep like more than four or five guys around. I just think that like that's just part of where we're at in college basketball right now. And also just the state of this roster a little bit. Like there were a lot of new guys this year that came in, like Dede Ames, Elijah Saunders, TJ Power. And some of those guys will probably look for opportunities elsewhere just because that's what's going to be best for them. I think a new coaching staff is going to have to make some hard decisions and probably maybe tell guys that there isn't a spot for them. And so, I think that there are a couple young guys that would be nice to keep around for sure, and a couple of veterans who could probably smooth over that transition in that first year or two. It's just a question of do they want to do that with their last year or two of eligibility in college basketball?
You mentioned that number 4 to 5. Five is a great number. If you get five guys coming back, that's a good number because you want to give Ryan Odom and Wally Walker the opportunity to build this roster. If you're trying to keep every player from a 15 and 17 team, like you're not really giving the runway. So guys have to move out in order for the program to move forward. So I think five is probably the sweet spot. You can kind of debate which of those five it is. I think you can make an argument for a couple different guys. Obviously, you mentioned the young guys. I think Ishan Sharma, Jacob Kofi, Anthony Robinson, those are pretty popular names of guys to keep around. I think Isaac McNealy, I'm going to be really curious to see kind of what they decide with their NIL money. Is it worth kind of matching whatever other offers he gets out there? Obviously, McNealy, he just signed with a new NIL agent. So I expect him to kind of look around and take stock of his offers, like we were mentioning. It just makes sense with the coaching change. Is he someone that you really just want to, like, all right, just got to pay what it takes and get him back here on the grounds? And I think he's going to be willing to listen to that. Other guys, obviously, Blake, he's already in the portal. Bliss seems like that's kind of been telecommunicated for, however long, even though none of us have talked to him. And Andrew Rohde's another interesting one, just because I don't know what his fit going forward is. Is he really a point guard? Obviously, he had a tremendous year. He's probably the most improved player of the season. Just it's a new, like you said, it's a new coaching staff. Cuts, just what do you think about this, the roster overall, the player movement this offseason?
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, to back up to the Blake situation, I think that's one of those situations where it's probably better for both parties, right? Like, a program like ours, you want your five to either be able to shoot and stretch the defense, or more likely, you want them to be able to protect the rim, finish around the rim, and in ideal situations, you want them to have like a post-up game or a face-up game so that they can get you some points. I don't think Blake, even with another offseason of conditioning, was going to get there. So, him moving on and finding another opportunity, I think, would probably be even more lucrative for him, but also, a good swap for us. So, no concerns there. I think, the broader roster management, I mean, you guys have alluded to it. I'm not going to be wringing my hands too much about any individual movement. I think, if it is Ryan Odom coming in, he's going to, look to identify to fill certain gaps, and he's gonna target who he wants. I think there's still a compelling case there that could be made, and I think, it'll be driven by how he sees this roster fitting together and who he's trying to keep. I think Isaac McNealy could certainly be a very good fit on the roster next year. It would be cool to see him there all 4 years. He's a shooter. I could see him playing kind of like not quite as good of a defender or as a player in general, but that Max Strzelga role that they currently have on VCU. But if you augment him with some better athletes within Ryan Odom's system, I think that becomes a much more, compelling situation both for him and for us to sort of retain him. So it kind of depends on that. I would go probably either or with him and Andrew Rohde. They're not exactly the same player, but they have similar drawbacks and similar things that they can bring to the table. But if it's neither of them and they move on, I think that's fine as well, honestly. I think the player I would prioritize most is Anthony Robinson, because it's really hard to get big physical centers in the portal. Those players cost a lot. There's a kind of a limited number of them. So it's probably better to hope to retain him and kind of develop him. See if you can get that sort of big, strong rim protection piece and kind of flesh out his game more. I think Jakob Kofi would be a really good fit in a Ryan Odom system. I think he'd be very similar to what they're doing at VCU now. But otherwise, I think there are some other players that would fit or wouldn't. There's not really anyone I would, prioritize over what's potentially out there and available with the potential resources we have to bring them in and the appeal of Odom to do so.
Yeah, the part that we don't know is kind of what targets they're going to be looking at. Players are entering the portal now, and obviously there's going to be a lot more as teams kind of leave the NCAA tournament, their NITs or whatever. And so we don't have the full picture yet, especially because we're still even waiting for Ryan Odom to officially be announced, if he is the coach. I feel like I keep having to say that,
I know.
but it's like. Let's kind of get it over with. But yeah, so I guess we'll see. I think, do y'all agree that kind of like four or five, I would say five players coming back, that's probably a good number for Virginia to kind of be around, just to have some guys already there. And you mentioned Anthony Robinson. Yeah, you don't think like a team like UNC would love to have an Anthony
Yeah,
Robinson this year
exactly.
with all their troubles with bigs. So yeah, it's really hard to find good athletic rim running, shot blocking bigs, and if you got a good young one that's kind of up and coming, you gotta try to keep that. But yeah, Cuts, you think like five is a good number?
Yeah, four or five. I mean, I didn't mention Elijah Gertrude. That's a big wild card. And I think, if he can kind of get healthy and improve his shot a little, he's exactly the kind of guard that Ryan Odom would love to play. We'll also see what happens with Chance Mallory. I know that's not retention, but there's some discussion about, him being in good shape with Virginia as well. So I think, if you're bringing in Chance and you're, keeping someone like a Gertrude, maybe one shooter, and then those two bigs, I think four is enough in terms of player retention, but five would be fine as well. I think if you get much more than that, to your point, you're kind of running into some of the same issues that you had last year.
I will say with Gertrude, he's expressed to me that he is planning on staying.
Oh, cool.
Obviously things change, but yeah, his plan right now is to stay. I think he really just likes being around Virginia, the culture. Obviously he's kind of been plugged in with some good NIL stuff, the Good Feet Store.
Yeah.
Not a sponsor of this show yet, but he seems like he's in a good spot, and he's really progressed well in his recovery. He told me he's hoping to do some scrimmaging this spring with guys before everyone kind of goes their separate ways for the summer. But and then Chance Mallory, I mean, things are kind of progressing towards that way. We'll see if that's what ends up. We'll also see if he sticks with that March 22nd commitment date, or if he moves that back depending on the coaching situation, or if he just kind of sticks with it. It'd be a cool way if he just committed, no coach signed.
Well, sure, but if you're Ryan Odom or whoever, feel like you want him to wait, right? Because you want that publicity. You don't want it to be like Chance Mallory just wanted to come to UVA because it's his hometown school. You want it to be the new head coach sold him, and now he's coming, and now there's momentum. Like if I'm UVA, and if I'm UVA and Chance is in fact coming to UVA, I'm begging him to wait until VCU or whoever loses, just so that we can all be like, ah.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe you just take him to whenever
That's the
he's
other, yeah,
ready.
no, that's a good point. Maybe just take him.
There and you know there is. Yeah, I don't know how much people talk about, but there is a strong connection between Chance Mallory and Ryan Odom because his sister Lexi used to be on the in the VCU basketball administration staff there. So you know, there's a connection there. They've known each other for a long time. And yeah, it, so we'll kind of. We'll kind of see if he but yeah, I think 4 or 5, that's probably the number, and we'll see where they end up this off season. But let's take a quick break. We're gonna come back and go through finally get to our season prediction review and kind of see how badly we did in the preseason, but not our fault, you know, a lot of things happen. So we'll be right back.
On the field, winning comes from hard work, care, and preparation. I learned that that same hard work doesn't stop when we exit the arena. Your care is our commitment, and preparation is our promise. We tackle challenges head on and turn dreams into reality, which is why I'm excited to join the team at Alcova Mortgage, where we help you score the perfect home.
All right, welcome back into the Who's On podcast. It is time, season prediction review. We're going to start with our player prediction, guys. And the first one, it wasn't too bad. Starting lineup on day one, all three of us kind of agreed. We kind of had a mind meld that said Day-Day Ames, Isaac McNealy, TJ Power, Elijah Saunders, and Blake Buchanan. Only guy we missed on was Day-Day Ames. They started Andrew Rohde on day one. We also had a couple different, you know, lineups, you know, that they could finish with at the end of the season. And you know, I think they pretty much used every single lineup variation they could throughout the year. I don't know how many I had it pulled up. Yeah, they've used 9 different starting lineups this year, which is seems like an extreme amount for what we're used to. But this one, Day-Day Ames, Blake Buchanan, Isaac McNealy, Andrew Rohde, and Elijah Saunders was the most used lineup. So Zach, I don't think it's a big miss.
No, and I mean, in terms of day one starter, like that was a pretty weird, not to like, start making excuses now, but it was a pretty weird little like, okay, Jalen Worley transfers clearly. And then it was just kind of like, it seemed like Ames was Sanchez's guy at point guard. So it seemed like
He was
that. And
talking
then, I
about
mean,
the
right. And then
boogie.
Sanchez said, like, I think post game of that first or second game, like, yeah, we made the decision like yesterday in practice, and it seemed like maybe Day Day had a bad couple days of practice, and then yeah, so I don't think that we missed too heavily there. I think probably the one that we'll get into a little bit here is expectations for TJ Power, but again, he was in that day one starting lineup and had a couple, I don't know how many starts he had exactly, but 5, okay, so yeah, he was in there for a little while,
I think it
but
was
yeah,
just those first
I
five
think that's what it
games.
was. Yeah.
Cuts. Let's go there to TJ Power since that's kind of the sore thumb in this starting lineup prediction. But what? Why did it just never work with him?
Yeah, I mean that's tough. And I mean the starting lineup prediction I think speaks to also how we underestimated Andrew Rohde's progression over the offseason, which was cool to see. And maybe we'll talk about that later as well. But with regard to Power, it's tough. I mean, I think a lot of it was lost confidence over the year, but also that he didn't really fit into what we do in any way. And also wasn't, you know, as far along in his development as he needed to be successful, right? But, you know, when we started that season, this season, he was playing primarily the small forward offensively, but then defensively, he was swapping with Saunders. and they were kind of switching off who they were guarding. So Saunders would guard the, whether it was the power forward or the small forward, the harder mark, and then he would guard the other. So defensively, that's actually, you know, a look at why we were better earlier in the season defensively. But offensively, we just couldn't get anything going. And early in the year, we were also running the new offense a lot more. So that was predicated around him kind of moving around the perimeter a lot and taking dribble handoffs and trying to get to the hoop. And he just really had a hard time getting off of pressure. People were always kind of getting over the screens on him, kind of blowing up his dribble. Kind of sometimes it was even harder for him to kind of catch those passes on the perimeter. So it was all kinds of disruptive, and he really just couldn't kind of function in that offense in that way. And then later in the year, when we kind of went more to sides, that's not really a great fit for him either, playing the small forward.
I know I'm kind of giving it away, but can you guess who had the worst 3-point percentage on the team?
Is it TJ Power?
It is TJ Power at 18.2%, which before the year we were talking about, you know, maybe he's the second leading 3-point shooter on the team. And it looked like he was never confident in the shot. No. And it also looked like, and I keep saying it, I never went back and looked at the Duke tape, but he had like a hitch in his shot every time he went up. And obviously for a shooter that he was pegged as, that's not comforting to look at.
No, I mean, he had a lot of, like, there was a lot of contests on his shots early on, and he had some really forced ones. And then he got to the point where I think his confidence was so far gone that when he had like open looks, he was overthinking it and sometimes just missing like really badly. So I think he had a hard time kind of mentally getting into a confident spot from that start and just never really got back there.
All right, let's go to the sixth man / most minutes off the bench. I had Tane Murray. You both had Andrew Roddy, which I guess kind of looks good in the long run because Andrew Roddy was, what, your second best player for most of the season down the stretch. The actual guy who had the most minutes off the bench, I guess, technically was Jacob Kofi. He did have, I think, 16 starts, but you know, kind of the starting lineup that we saw towards the end of the season, Kofi was playing the most minutes off the bench. I guess we'll take the time here, maybe just talk about Andrew Roddy and the improvements that he made, Zach.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think we talked about it when we did our stock up, stock down a couple weeks ago. Like Roddy, I mean, in unfortunately stark contrast to TJ Power, you know, his confidence was there this season. He was the player that I think a lot of us thought that Virginia was getting when he came on grounds, 2 years ago or a year and a half ago. And you saw it in his play. He shot the ball well. It seemed like he made a couple slight adjustments to his form as a 3-point shooter, which meant that he was hitting a lot more. He was confident as a passer. He saw the floor as well as it seemed like he could when he transferred here. And, you know, he sort of made this Virginia offense go for a good portion of the season. Obviously, it wasn't an elite offense or even really an average one in the ACC. But he was a really quality player. He wasn't a complete sore thumb defensively. I don't think he was a net plus, but he provided some nice size there. You know, he had his Ty Jerome moments, which were fun to watch. And he had that big three against Florida State at the end of the year. So, I mean, this was without Andrew Roddy, I don't know where this team necessarily would have been, probably even significantly worse. And, you know, as Cuts alluded to earlier in terms of like retaining players, like Roddy would be a nice one to keep at the same sort of with that thought in mind, though, it would also kind of be cool to see him go elsewhere and succeed, knowing that his time in Virginia, like, yes, it didn't culminate in an Elite Eight or an ACC, you know, championship, but knowing that he sort of got what he wanted out of it, he turned things around after a rough year, you know, personally and on the field or on the court. Roddy is a huge, huge, probably the best story of this UVA basketball season.
Yeah, he was one of those bright spots to kind of keep you going during the season. Surprise player, we all three had Jacob Kofi, although Zach, you added an additional surprise player. And I guess in one sense, you're right. He did surprise us a lot this year, and that was Christian Bliss, who never saw the court for Virginia. And, you know, now we'll see if he ever does, and it doesn't seem likely at this point.
Yeah, I'm not taking the blame for that one. That feels outside my control. I think it was also outside the coaching staff and the medical staff's control. So yeah, I don't know. I think in retrospect, like Bliss just probably wasn't the level of player that UVA thought he was when he got here. And he wasn't going to be in the rotation this year, even given Jalen Worley leaving and all the uncertainty at point guard. And I think Bliss recognized that. And it's a really weird and awkward situation. I'm sure NIL had some play in it, or played some sort of role. But it's one of the weirdest things that I've seen in college sports, and especially in such a small roster with college basketball. I mean, we would ask, there came a point where we were asking in those post-game press conferences about Bliss more consistently. It was just odd though, because every time you asked, you essentially got the same answer. Eventually, Sanchez sort of started to say, "Yeah, this isn't up to us anymore. This is him." Maybe he was uncomfortable with his foot. I don't know for sure, but that's not really what it seemed to be. If that had been the case, then we probably would have gotten more about it. He's seeing a specialist. He's looking at surgery options. He's trying to figure out more. Maybe that happened behind the scenes. I don't know for sure. So I don't want to totally jump down the guy's, jump on the guy. But really weird situation, as you alluded to earlier, Preston. The writing's on the wall. This guy's probably looking to play elsewhere next season. And just goodness for Virginia basketball, there won't be a player just kind of not dressing, most likely next season for no particular reason.
Cuts, the guy that I had as the actual surprise player, and I think Jacob Kofi surprised us in the amount of playing time, but we've talked a good bit about him. The actual guy I had as a surprise player is Anthony Robinson. You've been kind of pushing for him to get more playing time, and I think by the end of it, everyone was pushing for him to get more playing time. What'd you think
Yeah.
of his improvement this year?
I mean, I thought it was great. He's still very raw as a player, and he still was, making mental mistakes. I think we were in a world where we probably should have been living with those mental mistakes more often. Early in the season, I would have really liked to see him get more development. Like when he did get run, it was very clear that he was impactful in certain moments. Like, remember the Memphis game, the first half, he came in because of foul trouble, and that was like the best we played all game, and then we just didn't really get him run in the second half, and ended up, Memphis came back and won. I think we our philosophy with him early on was to play him if there was foul trouble, and then also not to play him with certain matchups, especially like small ball matchups. And we saw a lot of that with sort of the out of conference schedule. And I would have liked to see us kind of give him more run there to get him more comfortable and ramped up, regardless of the matchups, because most of those games we were going to win anyway. So I think we missed an opportunity to kind of get him going early in the season. And then by the end of the season, he came in and had, I think, a significant impact in quite a few games. There was that stretch where Saunders was hurt, so we were playing two true bigs between Kofi Buchanan and Robinson more often, and running sides out of that. And that was like probably our best basketball of the year during that stretch. His ability to kind of finish some pretty impressive, shots around the rim, dunks, etc. His ability to kind of help secure the boards and help contest inside, it wasn't perfect. There were certainly lots of room for improvement, but you saw the potential there. You saw the flashes. I think there's a lot there to continue to work on, develop, that I'd love to see us have for future seasons. And do wish that, maybe there had been some more effort to ramp up his minutes earlier in this year.
Looking at the leading score, we all got that one right. So pat on the back, we did it, guys. We got a prediction right. And that was Isaac McNealy, obviously. He led the team in scoring with 14.4 points per game this year. That was about 2.1 up on his average from the previous season. So he did make some improvements, and obviously a lot more offensive load was on him. So he kind of had to. Otherwise, this could have gotten even worse. But looking at we also predicted double digit scores. Cuts, you and I both had three. McNealy and Saunders. So we are right on that. Zach, you got it perfectly right. Both those guys averaged double digits. So win for Zach. We kind of played around with the third one. You said TJ Power. I was like, yeah, I could see it being him, but then my dark horse was Blake Buchanan. And neither of those was really anywhere close. But I guess, looking at Isaac McNealy, What improvements did you kind of see him make this year?
Yeah, I mean, I think he had stretches where some of them were, you could see him kind of adjusting and figuring it out. And I thought, it was pretty cool in that Georgia Tech game in the ACC tournament that, of all the players to really show up and step up, McNeely was that one. I think he had scored 27 points in that game, and he just kind of looked great throughout. And, hopefully, if we get another year of him, great. But if we don't, that was kind of a great year to, I mean, way to close his UVA career. And I think it showed most of what he put on display. I mean, he became more confident hunting his shot. He was still never going to break someone down one-on-one off the dribble, but he became more assertive about, taking angles and trying to get into the lane. He was finishing certainly better in the lane by the end of the season than he was at any point, earlier in the year and in years prior. He was, getting craftier about how he was getting open rather than trying to, use athleticism. He would kind of, he had that, move where he'd come off the screen and then he'd kind of like back up to the 3-point line and kind of lose his man and take the shot. So he was, he started to kind of get a better feel for like how to just kind of be wily and get open. And then just seemed to have more confidence as the year progressed. I mean, there were moments early in the season where he looked confident as well, but there are also games where he would just kind of get lost completely and kind of overmatch physically. So you saw that less as the season progressed, and I think that spoke to his sort of improved savvy, if you will.
Zach, I still maintain I'd love to see him as like a number two option. If they could somehow make that work next year, I don't know if it will happen. Maybe it happens for him on a different team. We'll see. But I just, what do you think about McNeely's season?
Yeah, it was, I mean, you saw a lot of what you wanted to see out of him. I think you're right. I think by and large, just the roster construction is what limited him. He's at his best when he can kind of roam off ball. Obviously, the comp is Kyle Guy or Joe Harris. And the reality is that Kyle Guy and Joe Harris had more scoring and creating options around them than Isaac McNeely had, especially this season. So, I mean, obviously, Guy had Jerome and Hunter, Jerome who could set him up and create those looks for him. Keke Clark could as well. DeAndre Hunter, who could take sort of that scoring load and make teams, McNeely is someone who teams ended up guarding with multiple players, just like, just switching the matchup or even just flooding multiple people to him whenever he was getting a ball screen or a pin down or a flare, because there weren't enough threats on this Virginia team to make them pay for doing that. If you get McNeely back, and whether it's Rhodey or you have another point guard that can do a little bit more scoring, and then you find someone. I don't think next year is going to be this like revolutionary year, no matter who the coach is. It just this is going to be a little bit of a slower build than a Louisville. Fans should be ready for that because the portal is still hard. You can't completely. It's not easy to do what Pat Kelsey did. But if they can find someone who can create a little bit in the front court, or even just another guard who could take some of that load off as someone who can get to the rim, then yeah, then I think McNeely's life gets a lot easier just because the defense can't totally key in on him as that, the top of the scouting report.
Yeah, and if I
He's,
could just piggyback on that for a
yeah.
second, like I think that's where there is some positive overlap with Odom. Like if you looked at some of the ways we approach this season, it's sort of a willingness to give those other players the chance, right? Like that SMU game on the road where McNeely was on fire and knocking it out, and then they just started pressing him and grabbing him. They probably could have gotten some calls there, but like really just overplaying him, and we continued to just force feed McNeely and not really even look at anyone else, and we ended up falling down the stretch of that game. Like Odom's team shoots 33% from three this year. They still don't care who's taking the shots. They're gonna take the shot if it's open. And so I think a philosophy like that, where you're just taking the open shot and you're forcing teams to guard your whole team, would be beneficial for a player like McNeely.
Yeah, he still sits right there on the edge of Kyle Guy for the career 3-point field goal percentage record at Virginia. He's at 42.2. Whereas Guy is at 42.5, so it's close. Moving on, let's go to leader in rebounding. I have Blake Buchanan, and guess what? I was right almost by default. 5.3 to 5 rebounds for Elijah Saunders, who was both of y'all's picks. We talked a lot about Blake Buchanan. Let's talk about Elijah Saunders. Cuts, I know you had a lot of Elijah Saunders thoughts, and just kind of the weird season he had. He was such a key player at times, and other times it just didn't seem like it was working, and just kind of a roller coaster of a season.
Yeah, it was, and it was an awkward fit. I think one of the reasons I had him as the leading rebounder was because I anticipated there would be more time from him at the small forward as the season progressed. There had been some signals early that they might be willing to do that, especially out of the new offense, and that really never materialized. Like, despite all the lineup changes and tinkering and the changes in offensive system, they never really gave that any significant run. The closest was when TJ Power was playing, and you had Power kind of at that small forward, but then they would switch. And so, Saunders was playing better at that point on both sides of the ball, but like especially on defense, because he kind of had that collective length around him that where he could kind of roam a little more and wasn't as solely responsible for boxing out bigger players under the hoop. As the season progressed and we got away from playing Power at all, Saunders pretty much exclusively used at that power forward spot. And so then it was really just the one center, whoever was playing, supporting him. And that is where I think he really started to struggle on both sides, but especially on the defensive end, sort of being able to help secure the glass, support, rim protection is not really his strength. He's better when he's kind of got some time to run into it from a distance. So, not to oversimplify, but I think, there's also an injury at play, and that kind of might have been impacting him down the stretch. But, if you look at sort of like the tale of two seasons with him, where, at the beginning, maybe we weren't as efficient offensively, but, we leaned on him more, and he kind of had a more natural fit and where he could kind of fit in defensively. And then over the second half of the season, when we got away from, those kind of lineup constructions with Power, he really started to struggle, especially on the defensive side.
Yeah, I think he really his best role would be kind of that glue guy, fourth option, fifth option, just a guy that can do a bunch of different stuff for you in the lineup. He's not the master of anything, but he's a jack of all trades kind of guy. If he could kind of fit into that, and like you said, he never really got a lot of run with Kofi and Robinson out there together. That would have been great to see just all that length defensively and what that could have done. So I guess we'll kind of see what he does going forward. But a decent year for him, and obviously it was a big uptick in minutes for him coming over from San Diego State. Leader in assist, we all three had Day Day Ames. Although Cuts, I listened back and you did have a shout out for Andrew Rohde. So congrats for like a half a point here with Andrew Rohde leading the team in assists with. What do you have at the end of the year? It was 4.3 assists per game. But let's look at Day Day real quick. He just the passing vision is kind of what leads me to have some doubts about him. He averaged 1.9 assists this year, and I know he had a good scoring uptick, especially towards the end of the season, but he's third on the team in assists and only averaged 0.3 more assists than Tane Murray. Zach?
Oh, that's a tough stat. I think Day Day's a scorer. I think that that's just the player that he is. You can talk about Chicago basketball. He just wants to hoop and he just wants to put the ball in the net, and I can respect that. I think as a pure point guard, he doesn't quite fit that mold, and that's just kind of what it is. Defensively, it was a little bit iffy this year. He wasn't quite the heat up the ball guy that Virginia might have hoped that he would be, especially not that Worley would have been, but just since he replaced some of those Worley minutes, you would hope that he would bring something on that defensive end. Really, his strength is trying to get a bucket for himself, and at times that was big for Virginia, but it also contributed to kind of a lot of their inconsistency on offense because they didn't have another guy who could help set up Isaac McNealy, help set up other shooters, put bigs in a in a pick and roll and then find them. Just because by and large, Ames was not to say that he was like selfish or just wanted to create shots for himself, but just like he didn't quite display an ability to create for others. And so yeah, I think that in these predictions, this is probably more so than anything, it's just a sign of a miscalculation of Andrew Rohde, which I don't think you can blame us that much for, considering
Yeah.
how he played last season or 2 seasons ago, whatever you want to say. So yeah, Ames is an interesting case. I think he's another guy who will most likely enter the portal and will probably be best suited somewhere else. And so, you know, as Cut said earlier with Blake, it's probably a win for both parties or a positive development for both parties on that front. So, you know, there were some fun moments. We'll always have, what was it, that Pitt game that he just like went absolutely.
27. Yep,
Yeah.
27 at Pitt.
We'll always have the Pitt game day day. So thank you for that. But otherwise, yeah, a little bit of a so-so season for Ames at UVA.
I will say, I think this was a good adjustment as the season went on by Ron Sanchez when he finally just was like, all right, he's not a point guard. Let's just
Yeah.
let him, kind of be that tertiary, like kind of secondary ball handler and just create offense when things break down. And that's when he kind of saw his scoring uptick. And that really helped Virginia down the stretch when they had the trio of guards kind of working together, even though defensively, like, there's a lot of flaws with that trio
Yeah.
of guards.
He also hit 39% from three, which is
Yeah,
like
much
something
better.
that's worth noting. Because if he shot like the 32% that he hit at Kansas State as a freshman, like this is a different conversation. He wouldn't have been on the floor, but because he hit, you know, 31 of 78 threes, not a super high volume, you know, he was at least playable, as you said, Preston.
All ACC honors. I think all three of us had McNealy and Saunders in some way because we included honorable mention. And obviously, in the end, it was only Isaac McNealy getting honorable mention honors. I think, Zach, you had Elijah Saunders as an all defense pick, though. I don't think anyone on this team was anywhere near the all defensive conversation.
Yeah, that's a bad one. That's just a miss, like straight up. That's just
I
a
didn't
missed
hate it at the
eval.
time, yeah.
No, yeah, but I think, well, I think it also goes to what Cut said. I thought Saunders was going to be the Swiss Army knife that sort of allowed Virginia to play a lot of different rotations, a lot of different lineups. And he just got pigeonholed, you know, for better or for worse, well, for worse, into just that four spot because of sort of how other guys fit in there. You know, we were at one point thinking like, is he a small ball five at times with TJ Power? I don't think he would have been great in that situation, but if he could play those different roles and own different matchups in that way, and also like he is an athletic guy that doesn't always translate to the defensive side of the ball, and I just think that he was kind of a step slow in those rotations, and some of that is just being in year one of, you know, sort of what Virginia asks its bigs to do defensively. So yeah, I think with all the all ACC honors, like this is just a result of UVA not being very good. And like if they had been good, Saunders probably gets honorable mention and McNealy gets third team. And you know, it's a little bit or second team, you know, if they're a top six ACC team. So that's probably, you know, we missed on a number of things, as I think many did. This is more, I think, a team-wide sort of miss.
I'll just wait. The misses keep coming because now we're done with player predictions. We're going to season predictions. I think this is where we were really off a little bit. I said before the season, big non-conference game that you think Virginia will win. They had a lot of big non-conference games. And I'm going to let y'all decide if I get credit for this one or not. I don't think I do, but Cuts, you and Zach said Memphis, close one, lost by 2 points. That probably that would have been the one. I said Villanova. I don't think in hindsight that pans out as well, but I'm gonna let y'all decide.
Well, I will give it to you. I can talk to Cuts, but that was, I mean, just analytically, and I'm a big KenPom guy, shocker. Like that's maybe their best win of the season or one of them. So like I think, especially for like how, I mean, Villanova wasn't good at the time, but, or at least we didn't think that they were, but like that win did matter. And like, it was like, okay, maybe they have a little momentum here. So no, I'll give that one to you, Preston.
Yeah, I mean, Villanova was playing really poorly at the
Yeah.
beginning of the season. So it was a little bit of a different team. They still have good players. I think that was a weird display of just horrible game plan and coaching on Villanova's side. I mean, I know they've moved on now, but like that whole game, they just played drop coverage on McNeely and let him shoot from outside, and it was very confusing as to what they thought they were doing and who they were worried about getting into the lane. I think it doesn't look as good now as maybe as it did at the time of the prediction, but I still think that was probably the best win of the season. So I think you get credit. Memphis was so close, and Memphis we should have had. I mean, we should have won the Memphis game, and I think it was disappointing in terms of, how it just didn't seem like we were in tune with what was working and why we were winning in the first half. And we didn't carry that into the second half, and that's why we lost that game. So that was frustrating.
Yeah,
Virginia
absolutely.
was so good in that game that Memphis went and got one of Virginia's players that wasn't
Yeah,
even playing in the
yeah,
game. They were like,
yeah.
this team is amazing.
Wasn't
We
even on
need
the
one of their
bench.
guys. Right. He was like behind the bench. And they were like, shoot, this team, we need one of them.
Congratulations to Dante Harris for being on an NCAA tournament team.
Yeah, there you go.
Second year running.
Yeah,
Yeah.
Villanova was their highest ranked win in the net, so I will take the
You
win
get
on that.
credit. You get credit.
They're 55 though.
Yeah.
that just
Well,
kind of speaks to
it's
the
what it
seed.
is.
Yeah.
Pitt was 61, just a little bit lower than that. Which brings me to our next point. What statement win does UVA pick up in ACC play? I said at UNC. I also mentioned at Virginia Tech just because they hadn't won there. Cuts, you said one of those Louisville games. Oof.
Nope. Not even close.
Zach, you said Clemson, which for a little bit looked like it could
For a
happen, and
minute.
that would have been a big statement win. But interesting, you also said if they could go 1-3 in that stretch against Duke, UNC, Wake, and Clemson, that'd be a really good for them. Well, they did that. They went 1-3 in that stretch. I don't think it was a good thing.
I thought a couple of the teams were going to be a little bit better. Namely UNC and Wake, so.
I put the actual one as at Wake Forest. Do you think that was like their best win in ACC play, or would you say the Pitt win? I guess because that's the net rating, but I don't know. What would you say, Cuts?
I mean, I think they looked the best in the Pitt game. The Wake, I like the Wake game. And, one thing I didn't mention about Andrew Rohde earlier is I love just how he was the only guy all season who didn't seem to blink in terms of just toughness or competitiveness. And I loved watching him, jaw at Wake and kind of, that competitive fire we've been missing. So, I mean, that was a great win. But I thought they looked their best at Pitt. That was the game when, they went fully to just switching everything on defense, which wasn't a great like long-term strategy, but it surprised Pitt, and Pitt was starting to slump then as well. But like, Capel, I think, has historically scouted our defense pretty well. He's sort of punished our hedging over the years, especially last year. And so the fact that we kind of changed the defense in that game entirely, it kind of caught them off guard. They didn't adjust throughout that game. So I thought that was kind of our most impressive kind of, making tweaks performance. That was also when we were kind of going more sides with our bigs. And we didn't have Saunders available, so we were playing two bigs the whole time, which was helpful. But so yeah, I mean, I thought we played the best in that game. I would have liked to see us sort of not then fall in love with that defensive strategy against better teams, and like once it was on tape, like kind of mix it in. I think that was one thing we didn't do very well this year. I mean, among many, but like when we found something that kind of worked, we would just kind of stick with it, regardless of whether it made sense, if it would work or not in the future. We kind of did it until it stopped working very obviously, which was, created a bunch of pain points throughout the year.
Yeah, I do like that Pitt. It kind of was the start of Pitt's slump and what eventually led them to not make the NCAA tournament or not even being close. I thought the Wake Forest one though, that was kind of the dagger that kind of put Wake firmly outside the bubble. So that's kind of why I picked that, just because it was a, Wake had everything to play for in that game. Virginia had nothing to play for, and you couldn't tell by watching that one. Let's look at the ACC standings. Virginia, of course, finished with the ninth seed, so they get that first round bye. This is where I'm going to take the biggest loss, because I had Virginia finishing fifth in the ACC, and thinking that I think at the time we were thinking, all right, maybe the ACC, like maybe we get, seven teams in the into the NCAA tournament. They were lucky to get four, and luckily UNC looked good to make the four look at least presentable in the NCAA tournament. Cuts, you had them at six. Zach, you had seventh. And of course, I mentioned earlier, we're flirting with the possibility of not even making the ACC tournament at one point. So, Zach,
I'm not taking the win here. I'm not even taking the win.
it doesn't look great, but by Price is Right rules, you are the winner.
Now, that's the thing. I just looked up the standings. So, okay, there were three games outside of seventh, so I don't really consider that remotely close. So thanks. I'll put this one in the trophy case
Thanks to
and
the Academy.
yeah, and move on to the next one, which I don't think is going to be as flattering
Yeah,
either.
the ACC this year, just when you think it can't get much worse, they find a new level to reach. I don't think it's going to stay at this level. I've got hope for the future that maybe there's can be some coaching adjustments, and now you're looking at UNC and they're kind of getting serious about NIL and getting a general manager, and obviously Duke's going to be Duke. Clemson, we'll see when, I guess now, Brad Brunell's probably going to come back now that the Indiana job's filled. So at least they can kind of build off of that, but they got a lot of veterans on that team. So we'll see what the ACC looks like going forward, and see what some of these other hires around the conference look like. Let's get to it. This is the worst of them all. Does UVA make the NCAA tournament, and do they finally win a game? Cuts, you're right. No and no. Zach, halfway there, you said yes and no, they don't win a game. And I take the big L here. I said yes and yes that they would win a game in the NCAA tournament. But they didn't make it, so now I get to fill out a bracket. Because I usually try not to fill out a bracket when they make it. So that's just kind of sums up the season. To talk about the NCAA tournament a little more favorable, do y'all have a pick for the maybe your final four picks or your champion?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, so I've got. Well, first of all, just to backtrack one second. I mean, I had them six, but I didn't have them in. I think the ACC was just not, I mean, it was just terrible this year, right? And I think if you look at, I mean, to Zach's point, there were three games out of seventh, but like the teams that were there were SMU and Stanford kind of range. And I think like we could have been this year, despite everything, I think kind of like on that par, right? And we just weren't for a variety of reasons. So, it was disappointing, but like it wasn't like we kind of fell in a strong ACC. I think we just underperformed in a weak ACC. So that's just
I will.
unfortunate.
Someone we had that mailbag in that preseason episode, and someone put out the 8.5 over under win total in the ACC, and we all hammered the over. Almost. And maybe if they had shown up in that Syracuse game, or maybe if that buzzer beater doesn't go against SMU, maybe we're right. But
Vegas knows, man.
yeah, all right. Give me your final four picks.
Yeah, so I have Houston is my sleeper kind of to win it all. I'm going with Auburn. I think they're going to rebound. I've got St. John's in there, even though I really like what Florida's been doing. I've seen something a couple of times this year and just really like just the athleticism they play with and the energy they play with for Patino. And then I've got well I just don't want to say it, but I do have Duke coming out of the other side.
How can he not? I've got Duke as well. I'm putting them straight expressway into the as my champion pick. I think this Duke team is unreal. Just the talent they have top to bottom. I mean, to win, I know the ACC was down this year, but to win it without your best player and the ACC player of the year, like kudos to them. So I got Duke winning it all. I've got Michigan State actually making it out of the South region. I went bold and I had Auburn losing in the second round to Louisville. A nice little home game for Louisville, a little chip on their shoulder for being the 10th ranked team in the country and being an eight seed. I went bold there. And then I have St. John's over Florida. I like Florida too. And I thought initially I was going to have Florida as my champion pick, but then looking at Todd Golden, he's never really been in the NCAA tournament. He's never had success in the NCAA tournament. They have not won a game in the NCAA tournament. So that I think it's someone said that's only happened twice that someone had not won an NCAA tournament game before and made it all the way to the championship game. So gotta have some doubt there. And then Tennessee coming out. I'm not a huge Houston guy, and I think Juwan Roberts is hurt for them. So there's a lot of injuries this year that kind of change it. Zach, what do you have?
Yeah, I haven't filled out my bracket entirely yet, so I'm currently just scrolling through this. It's tough.
I could change because I keep hearing things, and I've got till Thursday at noon, so sue
Yeah,
me.
see, it's odd. Like this, I know that every year it sort of is tempting to just do be a little bit chalky, even if that's not very much fun. This year feels like a year where like the one seeds and a couple of two seeds are just like very much like I don't see a lot of like three or four seeds that I'm like excited about. Like maybe Texas Tech, like Gonzaga over Houston is like I don't know if I'm picking that, but like that would be a sneaky, not sneaky, that would just be like I mean, Gonzaga beating up on Houston for leaving them in mid-major world. I have like a and I say this because I'm doing a little bit of writing about Tennessee. I think Wofford is like a sneaky 15-2, not even sneaky. It's like just out of the box. Like I think that if there's an upset, if there's an upset of those top eight, I think that's where it comes. Final four though is tough. I'll go like Kentucky as my a little bit, at least not a one or a two. Kentucky, Florida. Gosh, this is hard. Kentucky, Florida, Duke. I really don't want to do 3-1 seeds. So I'll go with Michigan State bouncing back.
That
Although
South bracket is so tricky. If you don't pick Auburn, then you're like, well, who do I think is going to come out of here? Like, because Michigan State isn't the strongest two. They've had a good year, a really good year. Jace Richardson's a good player. But I struggle there. So I pick Michigan State by default, but maybe I change. I don't know.
And
It's
Izzo,
if you know, you can
it's
bet on it a
Izzo,
little.
yeah.
But if Flag's not fully healthy too, I mean, the other thing I'm thinking about is Alabama as well. That's a potential
No, Grant
decent
Nelson,
pick.
though. He's not healthy.
That's true.
He's
That's true.
even more not healthy than Cooper Flagg.
Well, fair.
All right, it's gonna be interesting when obviously game's about to start noon on Thursday when this podcast is coming out in the morning. So enjoy the NCAA tournament. We will be on emergency pod watch for any UVA news that trickles out over the next couple days. But guys, thanks for taking one on the chin, coming back here and answering for our mistakes. This is what it's all about. But that's gonna do it for the Who's On podcast. We will be back whenever news drops or next week for our regular scheduled podcast time. But thanks for listening here on the Who's On podcast.
On the field, winning comes from hard work, care, and preparation. I learned that that same hard work doesn't stop when we exit the arena. Your care is our commitment and preparation is our promise. We tackle challenges head on and turn dreams into reality, which is why I'm excited to join the team at Alcova Mortgage, where we help you score the perfect home.